Chapter 9. A Dream Takes Shape. Edith Brown was delighted to see her friend Emily Pogson standing on the Ludhiana platform when the train pulled in at 1:30 in the morning. It felt like a homecoming, and everything appeared at its best in the lovely moonlight. The journey from Ludhiana to Simla was one of constant change, providing a sharp contrast to the plains. The train arrived at Kalka at 5 a.m., where they had early breakfast and put on some warmer clothes in preparation for the ascent to Simla by Tanga. The road from Kalka to Simla seemed to be wilder and grander than the road up to Muri, and the ascent appeared to be greater too. In the 60-mile trip, they climbed to a height of more than 6,000 feet. Along the way, Edith Brown had noticed various clumps of wild roses and St. John's wort in blossom. But on the latter half of the journey, she was overwhelmed by the glorious rhododendron trees. They were as big as fair-sized oaks and a mass of blossoms. Near Simla, there were whole forests of rhododendron. The vegetation was unusually fresh and luxurious. The roses appeared perfect, and there was a great abundance of ferns. Simla was a town about 5 or 6 miles long, centered by an old church and a newly built town hall. On one side of the road were English-looking shops, while on the other side were a large post office, a row of banks, and a dentist's office. Far below the row of shops, about 100 steep steps down, a large and colorful bazaar was spread. The rest of the town consisted of houses hidden away in forests of rhododendron, oaks, and firs. From the Simla Hill, the snow ranges were visible, stretching as far as the eye could see. The two women made it a special point to visit the Ripon Hospital, a good-sized, well-constructed building with mostly private wards. There were 3 English nurses on the staff to ensure an efficient nursing service for the patients. The visitors also had the opportunity to be present at an operation and were enthusiastic at what they saw there and in the thoroughly equipped dispensary. But the good impression was short-lived when they visited the Indian wards. Here they found a sharp contrast. The wards were inferior, and the nursing of the patients was almost non-existent, since they were left to the mercy of rough-looking caretakers. The missionaries spent 6 days in Simla so that Edith could become acquainted with it. Being the summer capital of India, it was the summer residence of all the top government officials from the viceroy down. She was surprised to meet an acquaintance from her Exeter days, a Miss Dockerwell, who was on a long visit to her brother, manager of the Simla Bank. On May 15, 1893, they started for Kotgarh, where Miss Pogson owned a house and some property. There they would spend their vacation. The organization of the trip revealed the Middle Ages feudal practices still existing in India. Each of the women was to have a jinriksha with 4 men each to take turns in pulling. In addition, they would have 3 coolies between them. Each coolie would carry 60 pounds. They were paid at the rate of 4 annas for each stage, and a stage averaged 11 miles. The coolies were changed at the various stages, and the man responsible for calling the men to this duty had to be paid 1/2 anna per coolie. The women discovered that the men, instead of paying rent for their land, were obliged to be ready to carry loads for one stage. The journey was made in slow stages, with the travelers staying overnight in dock bungalows along the way. For 4 days they journeyed, going as high as 8,500 feet at one point, and finally dropping down to 7,000 feet at Kotgarh. The scenery was breathtakingly beautiful along most of the way. The road wound among the mountain peaks and over passes so that there were wonderful views first on one side and then on the other. The narrow road, never more than 6 or 7 feet wide, was cut into the side of the mountain so that at times the tops of large fir trees would be on a level with the road on the lower side, while on the other side might be overhanging rocks or a steep slope covered with towering trees. The flowers were exquisite. Large purple and white violets, larkspur, clematis with big white flowers, and columbine of different colors. Near Narconda, the ground was carpeted with beautiful maidenhair fronds as large as dinner plates, shaded by tall fir trees, and towering above the scene was the dazzling background made by range upon range of the high Himalayas and the eternal snows. The travelers were surprised at the large number of mules they met on the road. These appeared to be caravans coming from Kulu or Tibet. They were usually loaded with charcoal, potatoes, vegetables, and other supplies for Simla. At some of the narrow points on the road, it was really dangerous meeting them, and sometimes they had to be unloaded as each animal carried its load in two large sacks swung across its back. The people they encountered were quite different from the tall Punjabis. These people had more of a Mongolian appearance, short, small, strongly made, with no beard but with thick black hair cut straight along their necks. Many of them were carrying timber, large planks about 12 or 14 feet long. Some weighed over 300 pounds. For carrying them 40 miles from Narconda to Simla, the men earned 8 annas. They tied the planks with ropes, making loops through which they placed their arms and carried them on their backs. On meeting people, they would cleverly turn themselves and their burden so that walking sideways, they would have the planks parallel to the hillside. These men seemed to be unable to get along without smoking. Not having a hookah, they managed an ingenious arrangement to get the same results. They dug a little tunnel in the ground, at one end of which they lit a tiny fire. They put their tobacco into the fire. They knelt at the other end of the tunnel, their hands cupped, and drew deeply through their hands. This device worked just like a hookah. They kept some damp leaves in their hands to cool the hot smoke. An illustration of the powerful pull of superstitious beliefs on the coolies was seen when the party was ready to leave Narconda. Since only one jinrikisha was going the rest of the journey, only 6 men would be needed, and the others would have to go back. A fierce dispute broke out among the men as to who should go on. Finally, Miss Pugson intervened, choosing the men she wanted for the rest of the trip. But as the others went back, one turned and cursed the chosen ones. This frightened the bearer so much that they sat down and refused to go any further. Miss Pugson tried to convince them to move by saying that the curse would do them no harm. However, they settled the matter themselves. The head runner changed places with one of the luggage carriers so that they felt they were averting the curse. In the midst of the natural beauty of Kotgarh, Dr. Brown found something repellent. About 1/8 of the cultivated land was a mass of beautiful, huge white flowers. However, this attractive display spoke to her of horror and suffering, for these were poppies and were being grown as a source of opium. Often she watched the women and children scratch the poppy so that the opium could ooze out, and she remembered the derelict cases she had seen in Ludhiana, the result of opium addiction. She also remembered little babies brought to her in the hospital suffering because the mothers had given opium to them. It grieved the doctor to think that the English authorities permitted and even approved the cultivation of this crop of human suffering. For almost 3.5 months, the two ladies enjoyed quiet companionship in their mountain retreat. The house was above the village of Kotgarh. Built on the edge of the pine forest, it was a spot of true sylvan charm. Edith Brown spent almost the whole day in language study, mostly sitting in the veranda of the cottage, but sometimes out in the woods. As a respite from study, each day she took charge of the tea, milk, butter, and bread making. This was a field in which she did not have very much experience, so she welcomed it as a new challenge and a change from her own routine. She had intended that the last 2 weeks should be entirely free of study, but that was not to be. One day, a telegram arrived by post from Simla saying that Miss Farrer was ill and requesting Dr. Brown to come right away. She dismissed her munchie, packed her bags, and started her journey back to the plains. Miss Pogson accompanied her as far as Narconda, where they met Miss Greenfield on her way up to Kotgarh. All three spent the night there, and the next morning the other two went back to the cottage, while Edith hurried on alone, except for her carriers. At Matiana, she found a group of coolies waiting. She made a deal with the new men, telling them that if they would cover the next 11 miles in 3 hours, she would give them good bakshish tip. The men were wondering what necessary work a white memsahib could have that she should be in such a hurry. She explained to them about her friend who was very ill, so they responded splendidly by reaching the next place in 2.5 hours. There was a delay of about 1 hour, anticipated because no coolies were on hand, so she decided to have some food. But before she had finished her tea, a man arrived to say they were all ready, so she hastened on the next stage. There she was surprised to find the coolies ready and waiting. The Governor General had been expected, and coolies had been put in readiness, so they took her instead and got her to Simla in record time. She hastened to the home of her Exeter friend, where she found a warm bath and dinner prepared for her, also a letter saying that Miss Farr was much better, and there would be no need to hurry down. She felt somewhat exasperated at this turn of events, but decided to make the best of it. At least she now had the opportunity of consulting with Miss Theobald, Miss Fletcher, and Miss Rock about their plans for the year ahead. All these women had been vacationing in Simla. There was one other person in the town whom she wished to see, the Surgeon General of India. Dr. Brown sent a note to him asking for an interview, which was graciously granted. That interview was of outstanding importance to the subsequent course of her career. For the first time, apparently, she expressed a dream which had been developing in her mind over the past months, training Indian girls as medical helpers. The great man knew only too well the difficulties which would have to be overcome, but he also knew the crying need for such help in that vast country. So he encouraged the English doctor to go ahead with her dream. Greatly heartened, she headed down to the plains, determined to find some way to work out her plans. A number of places were making demands upon her skill. First was Palwal, her regular station. She was gratified to hear from Miss Fletcher and Miss Rock that the last patient she had seen before going to the hills, and who had terminal cancer, had responded to the spiritual ministry of the missionaries. In the midst of her pain and distress, she had requested them to sing about that other happy land, and found comfort in their words. When they were leaving for their vacation, they said, "Mother, you'll be crossing the river soon. Perhaps we will not see you again." She replied, "Yes, perhaps so, but I am not afraid now. Jesus is there, and I have worshipped him now for many days." Sad because of the death of her patient, the doctor nevertheless rejoiced in this first distinct spiritual fruit of her medical work in Palwal. A call came for her to go to Delhi, where her services were needed for a lady who had had a difficult confinement. She wrote, "For the last few days, I have been staying with a lady here who had a little son born last week. It is a large house with every comfort and convenience, punkah coolies and ice in abundance. Such a contrast to Palwal. I was just thinking what a great many different places and circumstances I have been in since leaving home." From Delhi, she rushed to Bhiwani, 100 miles away, to cover Dr. Farr's work while she was recuperating in the hills. This was a city of about 30,000 and appeared fairly clean. Miss Farr and Miss Theobald were the only European residents. The medical work was more advanced than at Palwal, and there were usually between 40 and 60 patients at the dispensary each day. Miss Brown found that her period of language study in the hills had been very worthwhile, for now she could get on much better with the people, both in speaking and in listening. Living at the hospital with the women who did not speak English had been a real factor in mastering the language. During her time in Kotgarh, arrangement had been made for the marriage of her helper, Mangalia, and the girl had moved with her husband to Hodal. Dr. Brown brought another girl, Barakat, from Delhi, and began to teach her to read as well as giving her training in nursing care. Barakat, along with Rebecca, made up the assistant staff of the hospital. Neither of these women could be left on their own to care for an inpatient, so the doctor decided to move her residence to the hospital. A small room on the hospital roof made an ideal retreat where she could study, write, and sleep. At the same time, she would be available to care for any patients who might be admitted to the hospital. She called this her upper room, wondering if it was anything like the original upper room where the Lord met with his disciples. She certainly trusted that his presence would be there with her, guiding her and empowering her for the decisions and plans which she had to make. The small room was spartanly furnished with a table, two chairs, an easy chair, and a small bed. Two tiny windows looked west over a long stretch of plain, and one looked east onto the hospital yard. The walls of the room were whitewashed brick. It had an earth floor and a rough wooden roof. There was a doorway, but no door, so Miss Brown had to drape heavy curtains against the opening. She took dinner at the mission house, but had the rest of her meals picnic style in her little room. She had some company, which she did not particularly welcome, as she wrote, "Of course there are discomforts, but after all, not much more than one enjoys on a day's picnic at home, and I honestly do not mind them at all, except one, and that is flies. They simply swarm in the middle of the day, and having no door to the room, it is impossible to keep them out. However, I intend to get fly papers for their benefit. At night, I have frequent visits from bats, cats, and rats, which are sometimes rather daring, but I am getting used to that, too. If only the patients would come, I would not mind any of it, but they do not increase at all." It was discouraging to think that so many of the local women preferred to go to the village Hakim for medicine, and he took good care to spread all kinds of reports about Dr. Brown's medicine. He reported that they were mixed from dirty water. They were made from snakes. She had medicine which would turn the people into Christians at once. She would cut off arms and legs indiscriminately. If she took away one disease, she would give another. All this propaganda she had to combat with quiet persistence and demonstrations of concern and goodwill for the sick. She made a number of trips to the villages in order to contact the large number of women who worked in the fields. She found that as long as the women could drag themselves to the field, they were expected to be there and would not be spared to come for medicine to the hospital. When they were too ill to work, they were too ill to make the trip to her dispensary, and at that point, the people would just as soon die. These days, the thoughts of her plan for training Indian women in medicine were never far from her mind, and the forays out to the villages helped crystallize her ideas and bring them into concrete shape. The various stages of development were revealed in her journal. On October 26, 1893, she wrote, "From my diaries, you will know something of the great difficulties I found last winter in trying to do the district work unaided, and how impossible it was for me to leave the hospital to go out to the villages with medicines, and how equally impossible it was for the sick women and children to come in regularly from the distant villages, especially in the harvest and in the rainy seasons. I felt then how much more work could be done, and much better done, if I had some trained assistants, a compounder and a hospital assistant who could be left in charge of the hospital and dispensary while I went to villages, and two or three hospital assistants who could open small dispensaries in the villages where a married pastor was settled, or who could marry and settle in the village. I could superintend these, and at times they could send for me to see bad cases, or send them in to me. Well, The one difficulty is trained Christian girls who could be missionaries as well as medical assistants. On her return journey from Bhiwani to Palwal, she took time to visit both Agra and Lahore to see the medical schools at those places. She found both unsuitable for women students. In the great majority of the classes where women were involved, the teachers were Indian men who lectured in Urdu. The girls found this very high-flown language, and they did not always understand what was going on. Etiquette prevented their asking questions of these learned men. Of course, there was no type of religious instruction, and a voluntary Bible class in one boarding hospital was ordered to disband because it was not permitted under government rules. She also found that the few girls who managed to complete the course had no motivation for service in rural areas. They refused to work in mission hospitals because the salary offered in government service was so much higher. The moral tone of the government medical schools was not the kind that would attract girls from the better families of India, where a very strict code prevailed. They found it unthinkable for boys and girls to sit together in classes where lectures were given on human anatomy and biology. Nor did it help matters to know that often the girls had to meet with the men students after lectures to get the information which they had not been able to understand in class. For the year 1893 in India, such free association was not condoned. It brought only a bad reputation to those involved. Then the inspiration came to Dr. Brown that the solution to the problem was to organize a Christian medical student school in association with one of the mission hospitals. The women missionary doctors themselves could train Indian girls for the work. The steps she took were confided to her journal. So I wrote, or as I might say in the words of Nehemiah, I prayed to the God of heaven and wrote to the other lady doctors in the districts where Hindi and Urdu are used to ask what they felt about it. A good many are strongly in favor, and all feel what a good thing it would be if feasible, but some doubt whether the mission hospitals are yet large enough and whether enough lecturers could be provided. However, we are to have a conference in Ludhiana the week before Christmas to talk it over. Meanwhile, I have laid the matter before the ladies of the committee in England, and I will ask my mother to send around a copy of the scheme for criticism and a copy of the propositions since drawn up for consideration at Christmas. Dr. Brown had calculated the initial cost of the project to be about £10 a year for each student's personal expenses, food, books, and instruments, and about £10 more for their share in rent, teaching, and so on. She realized that this was a good deal, but in the long run, she felt this would be a very small amount when one thought of the number of sick women and children each student would be able to help. Also, it would bring relief from strain for the new women doctors coming out, for each would find a trained helper ready to interpret, to help, and to set her free at first for study and afterward for village work.